Are we ready to hop in?
Do we want to do a little, like what we're going to do at the very beginning?
Yes, I'm so sorry. Yep. I've told Ash the main...
Throw me in. It's all good.
You've recorded 25 episodes of this show, right,
Ash? Oh, yeah.
Welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn anything and everything interesting. Today, we've got on a very special guest who's going to be asking us a science question, and then we'll be asking them a few science and miscellaneous questions of our own. See how they like it. My name's Tom, and today's guest studied zoology and is a science communicator at the University of Melbourne, and is one of my favorite creators on TikTok.
Hi, I'm Ella, and today I am asking our guest, what is Australia's best animal?
My name's Caroline, and I'll be asking our guest, what's your beef with Blathers from Animal Crossing? We all want to know.
My name is Ashlyn Campbell. You can call me Ash. I'm Trash Bandicoot on TikTok, and I will be asking the question, how do you stop a gull from stealing your chips?
Oh, this is a science question, not just a tactical fighting question.
I mean, it could be both.
The answer, karate.
That's it. End a podcast.
Roll credits. We can all go home now.
Yeah. You solved it.
This is an advice show, right?
Yes.
This just happened to me. How do you stop this? I'm just calling in real quick.
I'm actually currently having them stolen right this instant.
Hi, I just called. Quick. No, but Ash, of course, you have a background in zoology. Could you tell us a bit about that, some of the research you've done? You also have a background in chips, is that correct? Or is it just mostly the gulls and biology?
I do. I have a strong background in chips, a variety of chippies. And I do have a background in zoology as well.
That was your minor, right? With chips?
Yeah, so majored in zoology, minored in chips, as you do. So I did my undergrad at the University of Melbourne, and I did my honours year in 2020, which was wild doing research in a lockdown.
Yeah.
So I was originally, my experiment was originally going to be lab-based kind of behavioural experiment looking at how changes in water temperature affect the reproduction of Murray River rainbow fish. And I spent all summer planning that experiment, and then COVID happened and it all got shut down, so I had to rework what I was doing. Yeah, devastating. Oh my God, I still think about those rainbow fish. And so I ended up doing a meta-analysis on the global impacts of changes in thermal regimes in freshwater systems on fish life history stages. So what that basically means is I was looking at how water releases from dams or from the cooling systems of power plants was changing the temperature of rivers, and then how that was affecting fish growth and like fish reproduction and embryo development and all of that. So it was a lot of spreadsheets and a lot of just data extraction from a bunch of different papers.
A lot of longingly looking at dams.
Yes. Oh,
just
my
staring.
God. The amount of like longitudinal coordinates I had to get off Google Earth was just insane. It was maddening because this spreadsheet had it had to have the exact coordinates of where the dams were, how far down the dams thermal effluents were coming and all this stuff. And we ended up with so much data that thesis still hasn't been published because we can't figure out what part of the data we want to focus on the most.
Wow.
So it just keeps getting reworked.
We have too much good data.
Yeah, you turns out you can have too much data.
I gotta say, this is very interesting to me because, and you know, I guess that this shows what the 90% of science actually is spreadsheets and stuff like that. But I have seen you hold a good number of bugs that have given me the heebie-jeebies personally on TikTok, and so I'm sure it's like 5% holding cool bugs and then 95% spreadsheets, but I don't want to sell you short also.
Yeah, no, I do love bugs as well. I actually I have sort of I'm very interested in pollinators, and that started in undergrad. I did this group project where we were doing an animal behavior and cognition experiment training honeybees to respond to vibration signals and make a decision based on that signal. Wow. So I absolutely just fell in love with bees through that. It was great fun. Like, it's one of those things where you think of insects as this, like, conglomerate where it's just, you know, a beehive is thousands of individuals. Mm-hmm. But when you're marking an individual and spending hours with it training it, you sort of notice that they do have kind of their own characteristics and personalities.
Wow.
Like,
that's so great.
Some are more curious, some are a bit lazier as well, or like try and cheat their way around the experiment. Yeah. No. They're the cutest little things. So because of that, like, I also got into some sort of pollinator work, and I worked as a research assistant doing some pollinator biodiversity surveys in rural Victoria, which was so much fun. It was just getting paid to take a net out and just catch whatever bugs you could find, which was just, that's like the best job ever. I was devastated when that ended because it was basically just that the funding kind of ran out for that. So they couldn't have the research assistants anymore. But like, I'm sort of looking at postgrad at the moment, and I'm like, I've got to do something with bugs. Mm. Like, you know, that you just got to have them. Yeah, you like got to catch them all, you know.
You're you have such a wealth of creepy crawlies as well in Australia. Of, you know, yes. Yeah. As if you were...
Oh, yeah. It's the perfect place for them, yeah.
I do also want to say, Ash, really quick, that training bees to respond to vibration sounds like science talk for training bees to like Taylor Swift or something like that. Like, you're playing music to see if they like that or not, but you're like, we see their reactions to various vibrational tones and see what happens. But people are just like, let's see how they feel about midnights.
There's a semi-famous study, which the title is that mosquitoes don't like Skrillex.
Oh, I've seen that title, yeah.
I'm guessing the study is that they played it for them and they didn't enjoy
just
it, but
tortured some mozzies.
I don't know.
Oh my god, that's so good. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately for the bees, we didn't play their music. So the experiments would take, like, some took like 6 hours at a time, depending on how keen the bee was to learn. So we did end up just like playing, like, so we were playing ourselves music. The bees were sort of in a less pleasant contraption. So we had this box set up, and it had a yellow square and a blue square. And in front of each, there was a pedestal with either water with something in it that made it taste bad, or sugar water. And so we were training them that they had to walk through this box, and as they walked through, it would either vibrate or it wouldn't. And we were training them basically when it vibrated, that meant, you know, go to the blue square and you'll get something nice. Or, you know, when it doesn't vibrate, that means you've got to, like, not go to that one. So they were sort of just going into this horrible little torture chamber that they had to walk through that would, like, vibrate as they went through it.
Well, I was going to say, it feels like a very... Dune Gom Jabbar test, where it's like you approach two pedestals before you. What does the vibration tell you to do?
That's exactly what it was. But some of the bees were really frustrating because they would learn that, yep, we walk through this chamber to get to the sugar water, but we don't like walking through that chamber because it vibrates and we hate that. So we're going to try and find other sneaky ways into this box so we don't have to go through that chamber.
That's
amazing. So they would fly around for ages just trying to cheat. Yeah.
But that just tells you something about their cognition as well, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't enjoy this thing, so I'm going to find another way to do it.
Yeah, and that's, I find that so interesting. Yeah, that they like want to avoid that unpleasant feeling. That's, you know, you could do a whole nother study on that.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I think because you guys did an episode on pain, didn't you, recently?
Oh, it was the last one. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, there you go. They're picking up on that negative stimuli.
That's so interesting.
Okay, so I'm going to set the scene for you first, all right?
Excellent.
So you're at a beach. You were feeling a bit hungry, so you decided you'd get yourself some chips, and you're out on the sand, you're eating your chips, and out of the corner of your eye, you spot it. It's a bird, but it's not just any bird. It's a gull, and it's watching you, and you know what it's thinking. You know what it's planning. So... we've got to figure out a solution to this problem. How do you stop a gull from stealing your chips? So chip theft is a commonly observed behaviour in gulls, but if we want to stop a behaviour... I mean, I observe it a lot.
Okay. From personal experience, I know for sure.
Yeah. No, but they are actually sort of known to... they're pretty bold. They'll harass people for it, especially in urban areas. So if we want to understand this behaviour, we've got to learn a bit more about its history and about, you know, how prevalent it is in the animal kingdom.
Right. Mm. Sun Tzu said, know your enemy.
Exactly. We've got to know our enemy. And so this isn't just a question. This is strategy. This is, you know, we've got to figure this out. This is crucial. So the behavior that's happening here is resource theft, which is more commonly known as kleptoparasitism.
Wow.
Ooh.
Science.
Great word.
Yeah.
Great word.
It's such a fun word, kleptoparasitism, and I'm about to say it so much, I'm definitely going to get tongue-tied at some point.
Resource theft did make me wonder if there are any landlords of the animal kingdom. I wonder if that's a uniquely human thing.
Oh, I would call a landlord a kleptoparasite.
Queen bees? Queen bees, maybe?
I feel like I was going to say, bees and, like, you've got your ants and stuff.
Mm.
Yeah.
Question for another time.
Yeah. Definitely. Okay, now my mind's racing in another direction. Okay, so the history of kleptoparasitism. We're going to go back in time a little bit. As far as I've been able to dig, the term kleptoparasitism first appears in the 1952 book Fleas, Flukes and Cuckoos, A Study of Bird Parasites, which was by Dame Miriam Rothschild and Theresa Clay. So this term was coined by women. Hell yeah.
Love that.
And they used it to... They used it to describe the Arctic skua's habit of chasing down other seabirds and bullying them into either dropping their catch or actually regurgitating it so that they could eat it. Yeah. So they are so mean. Oh. They will just harass any bird and they'll, because they swallow food into their crop where they're kind of storing it. So it's really easy for them to just be like, oh my God, I'm being mugged. I'm going to throw up and run away.
Well, I'm just picturing a school bully bullying for lunch so much that they're like, regurgitated, give it to me. Wow.
Although, to be fair, I think if I was getting mugged, I would also throw up and run away.
Yeah, honestly, like, defense mechanism. Seems like a pretty good defense mechanism. Yeah. Like, not a bad one, you know, confusing. So that wasn't the first time the Arctic skua behaviour was observed, but it was the first time the term kleptoparasitism was attached to it. These days, kleptoparasitism is more broadly used to describe instances where one organism has expended energy to acquire a resource only to have it stolen by another before it can actually benefit from that resource.
That's such a good definition. Because it... because... unlike the phrase kleptoparasitism, we can now try to, like, undo the human baggage that we are putting on top of it to be like, no, it's not about the law. It's about expending energy before you can benefit from it, which is really interesting.
Yeah, but this is such an interesting thing to apply to the scenario we're talking about where you're talking about an animal like hunting or spending time fishing. And in our case, we are going to the chip shop and buying some chips.
Exactly.
And that is the energy we're expending. Like, it doesn't have quite the same feeling.
Yeah, well, because it's like you've worked to earn money to then acquire those chips. So is the work the energy that's expended?
Oh. Okay. You know, that puts in a bit more context. But it just, you know, if I was like toiling the land, you know, getting the potatoes, making the chips. It feels more of a...
Yeah, it would sting more if they were stolen.
Instead of putting a DoorDash order. Yeah. Ash, could you say that definition one more time just so I can digest it again?
Sure, okay. So kleptoparasitism, it's used to describe instances where one organism has expended energy to acquire a resource only to have it stolen by another before it can completely benefit from that resource.
Can I say, it's so interesting because when you first mentioned kleptoparasitism, I was like, that seems like so complex and advanced because, again, I was having that human baggage. But when you say taking a resource from another thing without having to expend energy, I'm like, that makes perfect sense, like, for animals to have evolved to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it's such an intimidating word as well because it's like, klepto, like when you think of it in the sense of like kleptomaniac, you know what that means, but klepto by itself isn't used a lot, so it's like you don't have that immediate association for it. So before we go any further, it's important to note that all kleptoparasitism is theft, But not all theft is kleptoparasitism.
Ooh.
So Dr. Erica Iyengar published a literature review on this behaviour back in 2008. And so that review states that kleptoparasitism has to follow the rules of parasitism, which means that stealing has to benefit the thief and have a negative effect on the host. So okay. If it benefits the thief and the host is unaffected, it's considered kleptobiosis.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Now,
right.
this is where we get a bit sort of dicey. There's an article by Rachel Mirus titled "For Animals, Swindling Others is a Strategy," and she argues that a gull stealing a chip isn't kleptoparasitism because having a single chip stolen doesn't have a major negative effect on us. Now, I have an opinion on this. I want to know what you all think. Do you think that a gull stealing a chip is kleptoparasitism or kleptobiosis where we're not affected?
I'm emotionally affected.
I'm slightly traumatized by the event that's happened, and therefore I am going to be negatively impacted by what's going on.
Yeah.
Also, I will say, they won't just take one chip.
No.
They'll take them all if they can.
Yeah.
They're going to take the whole thing.
If you give a mouse a cookie.
They're like, even if they haven't stolen all of the chips, like, they're knocking them out of your hand, they are tarnishing the rest of them, and therefore it's never just one chip.
Oh my god, so I was at lunch with my parents the other day, and we were where there was like outdoor seating, and there were kookaburras watching people eat, and we watched as these people turned away from their food and a kookaburra fully landed on their plate, took like a shrimp or something and flew off.
With like a fork and a knife.
It was so ready. And so it was like, yeah, they couldn't eat the rest of that dish because this bird had fully sat in the whole thing.
Yeah.
I don't think that would stop me.
Admirable. That's noble.
I just have to say, I'm so mad that this chip stealing thought experiment is not just a bit, but is actually kind of useful, because now I'm considering my interaction in this dynamic, which is how valuable is the chip to me? And I'm like, I'm so mad that this is actually I'm thinking about the two sides of the equation through what I thought was just going to be a joke.
It's like, is this going to be a butterfly effect where you don't have the chip and then you don't have enough energy to cross the road in time and then you get hit by my Ford Fiesta?
Oh my god!
Oh my goodness!
The CSI people, they notice, they're like, there's one chip missing. Case closed. We know who did this.
That's his calling card. So I agree with you. I think it's kleptoparasitism because the way I was thinking of it was, we consider like a blood-sucking leech a parasite, even if it's only taking a marginal amount of blood and even if you can't feel the leech.
Great point.
And so in the same way, that one chip, you know, you worked to earn money to buy those chips, and that one chip represents a fraction of the cost and a fraction of the energy. So I would still consider that kleptoparasitism. Mm. And there are papers that consider gulls stealing chips to be kleptoparasitism. So that's what we're going to call it here. Otherwise, my whole thing falls apart.
The fact that you're saying there are papers about gulls stealing chips is mad to me.
Oh yeah, we're getting into that later. So gulls are facultative kleptoparasites, which means it's one strategy they use to gain resources, but it's not the only strategy they use. So if they don't steal, they're not going to die. They have other ways of obtaining food.
Right.
As opposed to like an obligate?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
I learned that from vampires.
So as far as we know, all kleptoparasitic birds adopt this approach, and most kleptoparasites across the animal kingdom are also opportunistic thieves. So facultative, opportunistic kind of are referring to the same thing in this scenario.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, but like you said, there are obligate kleptoparasites. So for example, female pea crabs in the family Pinotheridae have no choice but to steal to survive, because as tiny little crab larvae, they'll float around ocean currents until they find their way into the shell of a bivalve like an oyster. And once they get in there, they'll grow too big to leave and spend their whole lives just feeding on the food that the oyster draws into its shell.
What a weird evolutionary adaptation.
Because it doesn't eat the oyster? It just sticks around for the
food.
That's interesting.
That's so weird.
It sticks around for the food. As a point of interest, though, they can sometimes cause internal damage to the host just by being in there and growing. Mm-hmm. They can kind of cause damage to the gills and other sort of internal structures. And so most of the literature on pea crabs only labels the relationship as kleptoparasitic if the bivalve isn't damaged. So if it is damaged, the relationship isn't considered kleptoparasitic because the negative effect on the host is no longer purely from a loss of resources.
If the host dies, in this case, the would the crab just die as well? Because
yes.
Yeah,
so the crab can't survive outside the oyster.
Oh, wow. Yeah, good point.
So usually they don't kill the oyster, but they can cause damage. And so this I found really interesting because there are other animals like the skua that bullies seabirds that are still considered kleptoparasites, even if they can injure the seabird. So I think the distinction here is that with the pea crab, it's really hard to pass out what negative effects are kleptoparasitism and what negative effects are from the right. damage if it's caused damage.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas right. with a skua, it's like we can see it's injured the bird, but we can also definitely see that it's stolen a resource from it and we know that's going to incur an energetic cost. So I think with pea crabs, it's not considered kleptoparasitism because it would just be too hard to pass out what the effect is.
That's very interesting. I feel like it's a very common theme. Whenever we try to put rules onto animals, there's always exceptions and there's always little like moments where it's like it could be this or it could be that. But I think those are always the most interesting because like in trying to put on a definition, even if the definition ends up becoming muddy, you do end up learning something, which I feel like these sort of like edge cases are very, I don't know, they're making me think in different ways about animals.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's the great thing. It's just like, it's such a broad thing because the animal kingdom is so broad, it's so hard to pin down any rules for these kind of things.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so there's another rule it's worth noting. A behavior only qualifies as kleptoparasitism if it's between unrelated individuals. So that means siblings stealing from siblings isn't kleptoparasitism.
No.
Yeah.
Way.
If a sibling steals from a sibling, there could still be an increased indirect fitness. So then we're looking at kin selection.
Oh.
So if your sibling benefits and then passes on their genes, you're still indirectly benefiting.
That's so interesting.
I know, it's great, that one. So that means, like, you know, if you steal clothes from your sibling, you're not a kleptoparasite, you're fine. But they can be the same or related species. In fact, in insects, where kleptoparasitism is well documented, the parasites are often taxonomically related to their hosts. And some taxonomic groups are really good at it. So I know this podcast loves bees, and I'm happy to let you know that kleptoparasitism has evolved independently in bees at least 4 separate times.
No.
What?
Uh-huh. In fact, my favorite bee in the whole wide world, the neon cuckoo bee, is a kleptoparasite of the blue-banded bee. So can you guess by its name what it does?
Offspring. It
Yes.
gets the other bee to raise its offspring as my...
At, like, raves or something with the neon? I don't know.
Yeah, so it's both of those things. They're party animals.
Wow, I see why Tom wanted you to come on the podcast.
So they're kleptoparasites of the blue-banded bee. So the blue-banded bee female will dig a burrow and she'll stockpile pollen in that burrow and then she'll lay an egg and seal it off. And the idea is that when the egg hatches, it eats the pollen and metamorphoses into an adult and leaves. But if the female neon cuckoo bee gets in there first and lays her egg will hatch before the blue-banded bee egg. And her larvae will eat all the pollen, become an adult, and leave the blue banded bee larva to starve. So they're pretty brutal.
They're literally stealing candy from babies.
Yes, is what's happening. Literally. The babies are stealing candy from babies.
Wow.
Yeah, and so it's really interesting. These are considered kleptoparasites and not brood parasites like a cuckoo because a cuckoo is directly fed by the parents, whereas these are indirectly fed by the parents with food that's been left behind.
Right. Oh, okay.
So interesting.
And so it's hard to say which groups kleptoparasitism occurs in most frequently because it's really well documented in groups where it's easy to observe, like birds and insects, but you know, it's harder to study in less accessible environments like the ocean. But we know it's not impossible. You know, we have the pea crab, which is a marine kleptoparasite, and we've got another marine kleptoparasite. So wentil traps are a kind of spiral shell snail. They're these little tiny spiral shell snails. And one species, I really hope I pronounce this right, Epitonium clathratulum, feeds by sort of crawling up. Thank you. I was practicing that when I was like, there are so many THs in that word. I've got to like... So it feeds by crawling up an anemone and getting into the center of it where the anemone's mouth opening is. And then it extends its proboscis down into the mouth opening and extracts undigested food from the anemone's gastric cavity. So it would be grim. Like if you swallow a chip and a gull looks at you and sticks its head down your esophagus.
It's like, oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
Guys, so you haven't digested that yet, and that was your mistake.
Absolutely horrifying.
Lovely.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I would love to know what the first snail to do that was, like how that sort of evolved, you know?
That's a great point.
Mm.
We were talking in the vampirism episode about how it's believed that like blood drinking in some birds, there's very few birds that drink blood, and it's believed that they learn to drink blood by first like biting ticks and insects off of other birds and
then
from there just like biting a bit too far and like drinking the blood as well. And so I do actually this is pretty good too. I wonder how these sort of do evolve. I'm sure there are like maybe baby steps to it or they're using similar mechanisms for different purposes maybe, right?
Yeah, well, because they have that really long proboscis, and I haven't really read a lot about Wendell traps, but like obviously they might be using it for something else, like if they're preying, I don't know, on other snails or something, they've got to get like right up in there to get the snail, something like that potentially. Mm. Yeah, so that's a pretty nasty one there. So we do know we've got those marine kleptoparasites there, but kleptoparasitism is more well documented in some groups than others. We also know that the relationships have evolved independently in a bunch of different groups. In fact, kleptoparasitism is potentially the oldest known form of a parasite-host relationship.
Wow.
That is interesting.
So in 2020, a study by Zhang et al. Described some fossil brachiopods from the Cambrian period. So brachiopods are a really old group of invertebrate. They kind of look like clams.
I'm so sorry. I'm picturing just like a fossil of like one ancient animal like reaching into the pocket of another one, and it's just like frozen permanently for all of history, like caught on camera, like
it's just like on a rock formation.
Yeah, exactly. It's like
I mean, and that's it. You've described exactly what they found, so I'm just gonna skip that bit. Zhang et al. Found some fossil brachiopods from the Cambrian period. So brachiopods look like clams, but they're not clams. Mm. They're an entirely different phylum of animal.
Oh, wow.
But some of the specimens had these like weird kind of tube-like formations attached to their shells that had been formed by an unknown organism. So we don't know what the animal was because all of its soft tissue was gone. It's just this hard shell that's left.
Mm.
And so the animal would have lived inside the tubes attached to the brachiopod. And all these tubes were oriented in a way that the animal inhabiting them would have been able to actually intercept the brachiopod's feeding current as it drew food into its shell. So scientists wanted to figure out if these tube animals were exhibiting kleptoparasitism or if this was some other dynamic.
Mm.
So they had to figure that out. And it's hard because kleptoparasitism is a behavior and you can't observe a behavior very often in fossils. I mean, there are, you know, times where you can if, you know, there's like that fossil, I think, of the Velociraptor and like the Protoceratops where they're like midway through fighting because like they were hit by a mudslide. So like there are a couple of times where you can. But what they did for this was they compared the size of the specimens. So they found that brachiopods with these tubes attached were significantly smaller than uninfected counterparts. So that indicates that these tube animals were incurring an energetic cost on their host by stealing food. Wow. And so all those factors together are indicating a kleptoparasitic relationship.
That's like the definition of an energetic cost.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's exactly, it's showing, you know, how well they're growing, and obviously they're not growing as well. So that's indicating that kleptoparasitic relationship there.
Mm.
So it's existed for a really long time and it keeps showing up. So maybe understanding the kind of conditions that lead to its evolution could help us understand how our gull friends turn to a life of crime. You know, you've got to get in their mind.
It's really, it's the socioeconomic reason. It's like, it's all Reaganism is the reason, real reason why they resulted to crime.
Trickle down chips.
Trickle down evolution.
So there are a whole lot of factors that contribute to the evolution of kleptoparasitic behaviours and relationships because they're quite complicated. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you some of those conditions that might apply to gulls, and I'm going to give you some examples from elsewhere in the animal kingdom that kind of fit them. but really they're just examples I wanted to talk about. So how well they fit is kind of neither here nor there. So the number one key condition of kleptoparasitism is that stealing has to be less costly than foraging to make it worthwhile. So whether that means the stealing is easier than foraging or if it's safer or something, it's just got to incur less of a cost. Mm-hmm. So if fledgling barn owls aren't getting enough food from their parents or they're having trouble finding food on their own, they'll engage in a behaviour called nest switching, which is where they'll fly around at night visiting other barn owl nests and taking food from unrelated parents. And these unrelated parents don't seem to be able to tell that they're not their children, so they'll just feed them anyway.
No!
So they'll just like, sit in there, open their little mouths and like, yeah, I'm...
Mimi!
Yeah. And, like, they can get a bit aggro about it as well. Like, there's a video on YouTube of some barn owls doing this where the young will sort of land at the nest and the other chicks are kind of freaked out by it. And this intruder will just start kind of pecking them, like, get out of the way. Like, it's my turn.
So they're, like, older as well than the chicks that are still...
Generally, yeah. They're usually a bit bigger and stronger.
Wow. And the parents just don't even notice that there's this, like, huge, like, almost fully grown owl. Like, yes, mother, feed me.
Or at least like has a big lollipop and like a spinning cap, and they're like, trick or treat, me.
Yes.
Oh, I will say, although it is interesting because you have to consider like what is the evolutionary cost for the parents to be able to tell the difference. Like, is it worth that energy to be able to distinguish your children versus like occasionally feeding a stranger with like
a... Yeah, that's a good point.
For sure. And the other thing is, like, if you're feeding that stranger child, you know, maybe when your offspring are ready to fledge, they might go off and do the same thing. So maybe it's kind of a, you know, mutually beneficial situation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, interesting.
Great point.
Yeah, but like I was trying to find some studies on this and it doesn't seem to be super well researched. So it's a really interesting area.
Mm.
So another condition is that if hosts are present in a large concentration, that kind of helps kleptoparasitism evolve. So for example, mm-hmm. people living in like dense urban areas, you know, that kind of facilitates gull being able to steal more often.
Got it.
So it can also be between members of the same species. So male three-spined sticklebacks are these little fish that build nests in really close proximity to each other, and they do that so that a female can kind of swim by and like window shop and decide which egg she wants, which nest she wants to lay eggs in. And so she'll do that, she'll lay her eggs and leave, and the male will tend to the nest on his own. But males have been known to steal eggs from other nests and care for them. And why they do this still isn't completely clear. There are some ideas. Do you want to have a guess as to why they might do this?
Wait, so they're stealing offspring to raise as their own?
Yes. So they take care of these stolen offspring.
Okay, this is a wild shot. Ella, do you want to go for a guess?
I have no idea.
Does it make them look more desirable in the long
term?
That's
what I was going to say.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one of them. And I left out a bit of information. I was being a bit mean. They have a habit of doing something called sneak spawning. So they'll wait until a female is releasing eggs in a nearby nest and they'll zip through and quickly release sperm onto those eggs to try and fertilize some of them.
So they could be their offspring and they don't know. They're like,
exactly.
Oh, well, maybe this is my child.
They're like, it might be. So it's been found they tend to steal eggs right after they've done this, so it could be a matter of, you know, potentially raising their own offspring.
I'll be right back, hold on. I'll pick them up later, give me a second, hold on. I'll be right back.
I love the idea of them yelling as they zoom by as well, like, just
call you later.
So, but like you said, it's also possible that having eggs in the nest does increase the male's attractiveness, either because a female swimming by might see that other females have already mated with him, so they're like, well, obviously, you know, there's something good about him that other females are mating with him.
He's such a good dad.
Yeah, he's such a great dad, you know, look at him.
Look at him, he really cares about children.
He's really, like, babysitting, you know?
He's a single dad. He's, like, a hardworking single dad.
Yeah.
So that's one sort of way that it might make them more attractive, but there's another way. So males are also sometimes inclined to eat their own eggs if they get a bit snacky. So a female might choose to spawn in a nest that already has eggs to reduce the chance that her young will be the ones being eaten.
This is chaotic. Oh. This whole system is so chaotic.
Such a mess.
Truly.
There's babies from multiple people. They're being eaten by other males, stolen from... there's surely...
How is this the most efficient way of doing this? Yeah. You know?
It's absolute chaos. And the thing is, it could potentially be all of these factors that influence the egg stealing. Mm. It might not be any one of them. But yeah, I mean, like, it needs a reality show, like... house nest husbands. So another factor that we look at is that intelligence and learning ability also play into kleptoparasitism.
That makes sense.
Now, I think gulls are pretty smart, but there are smarter birds. So a really well-known sort of example of this is fork-tailed drongos. They're well known for giving false alarm calls to trick other animals like meerkats into thinking a predator's nearby. And when those animals run away, the drongos will grab whatever invertebrates the meerkat's been digging up. And so they're able to get up to a quarter of their food this way, and they prevent other animals from catching on and sort of getting wise to it and not responding, because they don't just make their own alarm calls, they can mimic the alarm calls of other species, and they'll also switch up when they're giving a fake alarm call and when they're giving a real alarm call to sort of keep other animals guessing and avoid like a boy who cried wolf scenario.
Wow. So good.
They're very, very smart. Yeah. So I think it's something like 30 different calls they can mimic.
30.
Yeah. So like males can mimic more than females as well, which is thought to be, you know, to impress females if you can mimic all these calls. But yeah, they're sort of little masterminds just hanging out
that's
in the desert.
That's so sneaky. I can't go over that. That's absurd. Yeah.
I kind of wonder if they get a bit of like joy out of it, like they're pranking other animals. Alrighty. So another one. Is high aggression towards other species seems to be advantageous for kleptoparasites. Mm. So some animals take this to an extreme. Lestromelita nitkib is an obligate kleptoparasitic bee. Mm. So this bee raids other bee colonies for pollen, but to do that, it has to fight off the bees defending the colony. So to get around this, it's evolved reinforced mandibles, and when it bites a bee, it releases a toxin from a gland in its mandible that causes its victims to exhibit uncoordinated behaviour and partial or complete paralysis.
Wow.
So at least gulls aren't engaging in chemical warfare.
So you're saying there is a bee that has mandibles and bites? Is one.
Yes. Okay. So it has these super strong mandibles and it grabs a bee and it releases this toxin that then causes this paralysis.
So not only do we have to worry about being stung by bees now, we also have to worry about being chomped on by toxic mandibles. Great.
I'm so sorry. It's coming from both ends. I'm so sorry.
I was going to say, whereas typically kleptoparasitism so far has been sort of like, you know, someone sneaking into your house and like stealing something. This feels like a bee just like throwing a flashbang through your window and then just like jumping in and just like knocking shit over and like punching shit and being like, it's mine now. It's like, that's a lot.
These are tactical bees.
Although, didn't you say that kleptoparasitism is only when the host isn't damaged? So is this technically not?
So that's where this weird grey area comes in. I think this still counts because you can still observe there's a distinction between the damage and the theft that's happening.
Right.
Mm. Whereas with the pea crab, it's because it's harder to sort of observe what part of the effect on the oyster is because of internal damage and what part is because of food being stolen.
That does make sense.
That's sort of what because it's not really explained anywhere why these would be considered kleptoparasites, but why there's grey area with pea crabs. That's sort of what I've interpreted from it. Yeah. But it does seem like it's, it seems like it is one of those terms as well that sort of is applied inconsistently to some groups as well. Yeah. Alrighty. So kleptoparasitism also tends to develop when species are closely associated. So, you know, for example, gulls live around people. They're very, you know, they're in the exact same habitat as us. Mm-hmm. And I believe you've talked about tuataras on this show before. So they're the reptiles that shelter in the burrows of little shorebirds called fairy prions to take advantage of their body heat. In an example of kleptothermy or heat robbing. So they're stealing heat from those animals and taking advantage of, those endothermic organisms.
Also, that's just a great term as well, kleptothermy.
I love, like, all the terms that come out of kleptoparasitism are so fun. That's not the last fun one we've got. We've got some more terms coming up. I'm so excited about terms.
As you should be.
I'm so pumped.
I was just going to say, we love a good term on this show.
So that's one example of reptile kleptoparasitism. We've got another one here. So when garter snakes emerge from hibernation, females produce a skin lipid that attracts male snakes, and the males will swarm around her trying to mate. So they sort of all get together in these huge aggregations. But it turns out that for the first few hours after males emerge from hibernation, they also produce these same skin lipids, which makes all the males around them mistake them for a female, and so they'll start swarming around this male. So this is a bit of a funny behaviour.
Yeah.
But it is a form of kleptoparasitism.
We're all like, why?
Just why? What's the benefit?
So you'll see in a moment how it relates to what I was saying before. So a study in 2001 by Shine et al. Found that when this swarming happens, the lipid-producing male, the one that's mimicking the female, actually warms up faster than if he was just basking on his own.
Oh, no my gosh.
Yeah. And so a later study found that once the male warms up, he's no longer attractive to other males. In another example of kleptothermy, that allows males to emerge later and warm up and become active faster. And this has a few advantages. It means they can catch up to their rivals who are already active, and it reduces their vulnerability to predation, because it means when they're coming out of hibernation and they're slow and sluggish, they've got all these other individuals covering them, and then they're also able to get away from predators faster because they're warmed up.
Oh.
This particular example, it makes the most sense out of all the ones you've talked about so far, because you're saying they produce a specific lipid, and that so in an evolutionary, from an evolutionary understanding, one of them had a mutation, they started to produce this lipid, they survived better because of this change, and then they passed that down. That makes so much sense to me.
Yeah, that is so true.
All the others don't at all. Like, it's so complex. Like, what you're talking about is such complex behavioural give and take. But this, it seems very simple in my mind.
That is so true. I hadn't thought about it like that, but you're so right. Like, so many of these behaviours are so complicated. It's sort of unfathomable sort of how they came to be. But this one, yeah, it's like, it's so clearly advantageous that it's like, yeah, of course. Yeah.
That said, I will say it feels complicated to me from a, like, social dynamic perspective, because, like, I'm thinking about this in terms of, like, a simulation, right? Like, this only emerges when you have a whole bunch of them working in tandem, as opposed to, like, A takes B. It's like all these things, and especially with heat being such a, like, nebulous thing take, it's simultaneously very complicated also.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's true as well, because it's like the swarming had to occur before the female mimicry could be advantageous.
Yeah.
So I guess they had to develop that behavior first.
Very interesting.
I love it, yeah. Yeah, and it's sort of such an interesting area, but it seems like there's not many sort of people working on this. Like, it's basically just this one researcher that's kind of been leading all these studies on it that's coming out, like, every five or so years.
Wow. You'll love to see it.
So a lot of these examples have something in common, which is that the thieving animals are engaging with species that can acquire resources the other animals couldn't access. So it's sort of like, it's something that it's providing an advantage, because those animals wouldn't get it if, you know, the meerkats weren't digging up the bugs, or, you know, like, the anemone wasn't catching food before the spiral shell snail could sort of get in there.
And seagulls can't buy their own chippies.
Exactly. You know, it's a travesty. Seagull rights now, come on.
So is the solution just to allow seagulls
to open a bank account?
To buy chips? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
If we give a seagull economy. Yeah. is that how we fix this? I think so.
I think it is, yeah. I think if we emancipate the seagulls.
Social programs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of these examples have something in common, which is that thieving animals are engaging with species that can acquire resources you otherwise couldn't access. So if we look at hydroid colonies, they're made up of loads of individual animals called polyps that look kind of like slender anemones. And these polyps eat zooplankton. And there's a nudibranch called Cretina peregrina that shelters in these hydroid colonies and eats the individual polyps. So if the thing you're eating is also your shelter, it's only sustainable if you can get enough nutrients without depleting your habitat. So scientists wanted to figure out how they do this.
It's like living in the gingerbread house.
Exactly. They're living in the natural world gingerbread house. made up of tiny little tentacled things. Oh God, imagine if the gingerbread house had tentacles.
Happy Halloween!
Yay!
and so also so these are basically like little sea slugs living amongst these tentacled, almost like,
yeah. So they're teeny weeny little tiny ones. So basically, it's kind of like if you were to look up a photo of it, it's like you've got this sea slug, and then what they're on almost looks like a thin, spindly seaweed, but it's actually a bunch of these little polyps making up these sort of big superorganisms. And the polyps, so it's like the polyps eat zooplankton, the nudibranch eats the polyps.
Right.
So they found that this nudibranch doubles its attack rate on polyps that have recently consumed zooplankton. So what it's doing is it's gaining the nutrients of both the polyp and the zooplankton, which means it doesn't need to eat as much to survive. And so it's not depleting the colony as quickly because it's getting both of those nutrients. So this behavior isn't so much kleptoparasitism. It's actually been labeled kleptopredation because the nudibranch essentially steals the nutrients of the zooplankton by eating the polyp before it's had time to digest.
But at the same time, I can totally see how this could evolve into kleptoparasitism, you know, given millions of years, right? Because this is sort of like the start of it, is it starts as predation and then could turn into,
yeah, well, that's the thing, and it's that closely associated relationship as well. So it's got kind of all of these factors that could potentially facilitate that. And it also depends, you know, that the polyps are individual animals, but they're sort of creating this superorganism, so it depends on sort of what level you're looking at as well.
So
Dr. Trevor Willis, who led the study, describes it as the nudibranch using polyps as a fishing rod to access plankton it otherwise wouldn't have. So it'd be like if you finish your chips and the gull that's been watching you unhinges its jaw and swallows you.
Oh, no. Wow. It could be worse.
Yep. That's actually the subliminal messaging of this, is making you grateful that our problem is gulls.
That's all they want.
It's just a chip.
What you're saying, I think, is in millions of years, seagulls will evolve to be humans' natural predators.
Yes, that's actually the road that we're going down. So buckle in, everyone.
That's also such a terrifying fear, to be like, oh, God, I'm so full. It's like, wait, what did you say? It's like, and you hear in the back, like,
all the gulls just raise their hands.
So dumb.
So there's another similar situation that's not quite kleptoparasitism. It's kleptoplasty, which sounds like a cosmetic surgery.
Oh, but it's not.
Yeah. Like, oh my God, did you get kleptoplasty? You look great. Yeah, I just had a little procedure.
I have longer fingers to steal with now.
Yeah. Oh, that's horrifying. So some species of Sacoglossan sea slug will eat algae and incorporate the algae's chloroplasts into the cells of their digestive lining.
Oh,
and they're
okay.
able to use the energy produced as the chloroplasts continue to photosynthesize for months. Mm-hmm. So they can actually go months at a time without eating because they're just using the energy produced by these organelles that are slowly degrading inside them.
Wow. That's it's really like cool. Eating a battery and being able to survive from that.
It's so great, and they're so cool. They all look really green because they just got all these chloroplasts in them. They're really neat.
I feel like, Caroline, you've done a video on these guys, right?
I freaking love these little guys. Would definitely recommend. I've done several videos on these sorts of
they're so cute.
I think they're so cute. Yeah, they're just like, they look like teeny tiny little sheep.
Yeah.
They're amazing. Or some of them do, anyway. Yeah.
I think one of their names is like sea bunnies or something, because some of their little sort of appendages look like little bunnies.
They're so cute.
So similar to this, there are actually instances of kleptoparasitism where animals steal from plants. So for example, the larvae of the Toxomyris fly. Yeah, so it's like, again, you've got these close associations and, you know, animals are often sort of really closely interacting with plants. So the Toxomyris flies have their larvae living on sundew, and sundew are carnivorous plants. And so the larvae is a kleptoparasite of this plant, because what it does is it steals the prey that's caught in its sticky appendages. So they sort of avoid all of the stickiness, and they can kind of get up in there and take any food that's been caught.
Wow.
But you can also look at other things. So this is my favorite kleptoparasite term. I said before I was excited about terms. This is the one that I love. So you can look at instances of something called floral larceny.
Oh, I love that one. It's incredible.
Great.
Oh, yeah.
Where the first time I saw a paper with that in it, I was like, oh my God, like that is the best thing ever. That's going to be a number plate. So floral larceny is where an animal takes nectar or pollen from a flower, gaining the nutritional benefits without pollinating the flower in return. So flower piercer birds are really good at this. They have specialized upturned beaks. So their hooked upper mandible will hold onto a flower while the lower mandible pierces the base of it so they can access the nectar and bypass the pollen. So the pollen's in anthers sort of at the top of the flower and the nectar's in a reservoir at the bottom. So they're just sort of getting at that and not pollinating it.
I just find that it's, why is that beneficial though? I know. Why is not, like, pollination is beneficial to those birds because there are more of those flowers for them to have. So
exactly.
I don't understand what the point of not, you know.
It just feels like a real dick move, you know.
It's just evolution, be like, nah.
This is like the animal equivalent of like that like glass cutter so that they can break away the case and like, get through the security system to just get to the...
It's the most high-tech thing. I imagine as well it would partially be because getting sort of into a flower and getting past those anthers is slightly more energetically costly than just kind of sticking your beak in the base of a flower, potentially. Yeah. That's just, that's honestly me just throwing that speculation out there. So this is great. We have insects stealing from carnivorous plants. We have floral larceny, where would-be pollinators steal from flowering plants. But we can remix this, okay? So what about carnivorous plants stealing insect pollinators from flowering plants?
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. This is a fun one. So this is an instance of plant-on-plant kleptoparasitism.
I love this. Oh my goodness.
So, in 2018, two species of sundew in Japan were found to capture more insects when they were surrounded by flowering plants that attract pollinators. Because what they were doing was drawing pollinators away from those plants and trapping them. So in this case, the resource is the pollinator.
Mm. Wow.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Interesting. That's so...
It's that sort of negative impact on the flowering plant because they've sort of put all this effort into producing nectar to attract those pollinators.
Yeah.
And then they're having those taken away from them.
This, again, makes so much sense to me because, like, again, it can be completely accidental that these two plants would have grown next to each other on, like, one occasion and it just happened to have this impact, which now is, like, very desirable for the carnivorous plant. That's so interesting.
Yeah, so that's what these researchers were kind of looking at, was, like, comparing the sundew that were surrounded by flowering plants to those that weren't, to sort of see that difference.
Wow.
Alrighty. So, back to the pressing matter. We want to stop gulls from stealing our chips.
Yeah.
So, how are we going to do that? So, a few manners of dealing with kleptoparasitism are listed in Iyengar's review based on an earlier paper by CJ Barnard. And he's done, like, a bunch of studies on kleptoparasitism. So, he shows up a lot. So, we could take lions and hyenas, whose relationship is a lot more complicated than it tends to be portrayed. Lions steal from hyenas as well.
You're saying Lion King was propaganda.
I'm saying it was pure propaganda. Justice for my hyenas. They're beautiful babies and I love them. And they employ three of these tactics. So there's cooperation, which is where each group, lions and hyenas, will both form large prides and large clans to try and combat the other and stop them from stealing from them. Then we've got retaliation, where they'll fight back. And the third tactic is evasion. So a study led by the University of Granada found that hyenas will actually change their circadian rhythm when they share an area with lions, shifting their activity patterns.
No way.
Yeah. They go from nocturnal to diurnal, active during the day, to avoid encounters with lions because they don't want to be stolen from.
Okay, sorry. So say that. So say the three things again.
Sure.
Cooperation, combating, and running away.
Yeah, so cooperation, retaliation, and evasion. Yeah.
So if we apply this to our situation.
Yeah.
Yep, that's what I was thinking. Yep.
Either we start to, if you want chips, you have to.
Buddy system.
Have to be in a huge group of people also eating chips.
Yes.
It takes a village.
Or, as I said at the start, retaliation, you have to fight the seagull.
Karate.
Or evasion, you have to constantly be on the move while eating chips.
Yes.
Or you have to be a big fan of midnight chips.
Oh, yes, nighttime chips. Midnight chips. I don't think that'll stop them, though.
Honestly, though, like, I don't know how it is where y'all are, but, like, here in Melbourne, gulls are still around in the city at night. Like, they're still flying around. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how well these tactics would work for us. I'm not confident I could win in a fight against a gull. So
no one can.
I don't want to get into that scrap. So there are a couple of other strategies we could try looking at. We've got toleration.
Sorry.
Yeah, it sounds grim. For example, sea otter females don't retaliate after male sea otters steal from them, but you can't blame them because sea otter males are terrifying animals. So they've been known to steal from females by creating hostage situations. So they've
get the fuck out of town.
They're horrible. So they've been observed watching a female and her pup and waiting until the female dives to forage on the seafloor. And then they'll come over to the pup, force it underwater, and hold it there until the female resurfaces, sees what's
Jesus
going on.
Christ.
She then drops her catch to come over and intervene, no. At which point the male leaves the pup alone and goes over and grabs whatever food she's dropped. It's diabolical.
Well, Batman, which will you pick, your child or the food? I'll drop both at the same time.
It's the machinations of it. It's just like the idea that they're watching and waiting and planning.
That's like literally what the Green Goblin does to Spider-Man a few times.
That's brutal.
Oh my God. They Gwen Stacy the pups.
Oh God.
Just awful. So this strategy probably won't work for us because toleration, you know, I mean, it could work, but it's like then, you know, it's like, it's just not nice. It's like you're being stolen from and you're kind of being walked all over. It's not a good time.
Right. It's you either lose your chips or you keep your chips long enough that you become the villain.
Yeah. It's like there's no good outcome here. It's like it's all terrible. So there's one more that was named. So compensation. And I find this one really interesting. So compensation just means the victim will go and forage some more or seek out food more frequently if it's being stolen. But it can have really far-reaching effects. So black bears will intimidate pumas off a kill so they can take it for themselves. And when this is happening, pumas spend less time feeding on a kill. So a study published last year by Allen et al. Found that in response to this aggressive kleptoparasitism, pumas shorten the time between kills by 1.3 days. So it means they're hunting more frequently and increasing their kill rates. So in this case, we're seeing kleptoparasites actually impacting the top-down control of an ecosystem.
Wow.
Okay, so buy more chips.
Yep,
I'm buy thinking, more chips. Yeah.
When you want a small, order a large.
Exactly. Hunt more frequently for chips. But then it's like, you know, then it's like you're spending more money and that's just not a good time. And in this economy, you know. So the thing is, right, none of these are really fitting. Maybe none of this helps us. I mean, none of these animals are gulls. So maybe what we should be doing is looking specifically at how animals deal with thieving gulls. And thankfully, a researcher named Des Thompson looked at how other animals deal with thieving gulls in 1986. And Thompson observed gulls stealing worms from plovers and recorded that when a gull was nearby, the plovers actually discarded big worms in favour of smaller worms to reduce the chance that gulls hanging around would steal from them.
Ooh.
So animals can choose less valuable resources so that they're not worth stealing from.
What?
But I don't really like the solution to our problem having...
Eat worse chips.
Yeah, like it's, that's the darkest timeline. I'm not a fan of that one.
I'd rather fight the gull.
So the thing is, even if we did decide to choose, you know, worse chips or fewer chips to discourage gulls from stealing from us, that might not work. Because when organisms are coming up with all of these ways of dealing with theft, it's important that the kleptoparasite can weigh up the cost and benefits of stealing. So it's important to take into account a whole breadth of interacting factors influencing kleptoparasitic behaviours. So Thompson's study with the plovers and gulls found that whether gulls decided to steal didn't just depend on the size of the worm. It also depended on how much energy it would take to steal and the probability of stealing being successful.
Oh.
And then there was another umbrella condition. So those two factors were both influenced by the likelihood of the gull being detected by the plover as it approached.
Oh, interesting.
It's not that simple.
So they're weighing up all of these things, and a more recent study also looked at how gulls weigh up the likelihood of detection when deciding whether or not to steal your chips.
Oh, wait. Okay. Oh, okay. I can't believe this has actually been studied.
I'll explain why at the end as well. There is a reason that this is being studied.
It's Big Chip.
It's Big Chip.
No, it's clearly a personal vendetta by the researcher who's had too many chips stolen.
The researcher has a villain origin story. I feel like Big Chip would be against this research because gulls are making you buy more chips.
Yeah.
Ooh, exactly. Good point.
Who do you think is training all these gulls? It's a Big Chip. By the way, I'm just very briefly, I'm tremendously swallowing my American pride by saying chip as if that's a normal word that we all use for fries.
It is chip and it is nothing else.
Yeah, all right.
There is
correct.
No other
you
word.
You are fully overruled here,
yeah,
Tom.
Yeah, sorry, Tom.
All right.
Outnumbered.
Need more American guests. Writing that down.
Chip or chippy. I'm a fan of chippy. Alrighty. So, researchers at the University of Exeter measured the time it took herring gulls to approach and touch a transparent bag of chips. And that bag of chips was placed... It had to be transparent so they could see the chips.
Yeah.
Okay.
They've got
this
to know...
This is great experimental design.
Because they don't want them getting the chips, but they've got to know they're there. So, okay. So that bag of chips was placed near a person who either looked directly at an approaching gull or looked away.
No way.
So just a note for this study, the sample size isn't huge. Researchers targeted 74 individual gulls for the experiment, but they could only base their analysis on gulls that fully completed the study trials by actually approaching and touching the chips when experimenters were looking away. And only 19 gulls ended up doing that.
Okay.
So they took this as an indication that food snatching is only conducted by a minority of individuals, but that would vary across contexts and populations. Like in Thompson's study, every gull stole worms. So when experimenters were looking away, all of these 19 gulls approached and touched the chips. When experimenters were looking at them, the gulls took significantly longer to approach the food and 6 of them wouldn't touch the chips at all. So these results indicate that herring gulls are capable of gaze recognition. So they know where someone's looking. Yeah. And they have an aversion to the human gaze, which means that if you want to stop a gull from stealing your chips, it might be enough to just make them real uncomfortable with way too much eye contact.
No, that's crazy.
This kind of reminds me of people who, I think it's trying to avoid being attacked by tigers. And like, tigers are the same sort of thing. Like, if you're looking at it, it probably won't approach you. So they would put masks on the backs of their heads so that it always looked like they were looking. And now I think I just need to get a little mask to go on the back of my head so that I can eat my chips in peace.
Oh my God, patent that. Patent that. Marketing opportunity.
Buy Caroline mask from the merch store.
Yeah.
Now in our shop, letslearneverything.com/shop. I was going to say, I feel like I'm going to get this mixed up with like the brown bear, black bear thing where I'm like, am I supposed to look at them or am I supposed to play dead? I can't remember which of these I'm supposed
climate
to
tree,
do.
Climate tree.
Yeah, exactly.
It's good to know that if you look into a seagull's eyes, it might back down because I just get the impression that that'll just rile it up.
Yeah.
I get that feeling from them.
Oh, it's like a challenge.
They are pretty aggressive, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was trying it at the tram stop the other day because there were some gulls around and I was just kind of staring at them, but like I didn't have food, so like I have no idea if they even cared about me.
So you were actually just staring at some gulls?
I was just a weirdo staring at some gulls.
Yeah, unless you have a transparent bag of chips, you're just being a weirdo, I think.
Just absolutely zeroed in.
So is that our answer then?
That's our answer. So next time you're at the beach, just absolutely stare down the gulls, ignore everyone around you. You've got to be looking at those gulls.
Don't be spending time with your friends, family, whoever at the beach with. You've got
absolutely
to be staring down, like eating your chips, staring at a gull.
Or wear those masks.
Yes.
Those patented Caroline face masks.
Yeah, paint like eyes on your eyelids so that you can like enjoy your chip with your eyes closed and still be staring at them. You know, you fully commit to this. So dumb, but that's so interesting.
I love it because it's such an anticlimactic solution. We've been like fighting them.
Just look at
them. We've been like strategizing all these things. We've been, you know, changing timelines and everything.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Stare at seagulls. I've made a note.
So,
Tamari just like, what was I doing?
I'll also explain why this research was happening. So it wasn't just a vendetta.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
So it's looking at as sort of animals are sort of coming into where humans are living, and as human ranges expand, we're having to sort of live alongside animals more. And herring gulls in the UK, their population is actually declining at the moment, but they're doing all right in urban areas. So that could potentially be a refuge for them in future. So this study was looking at a common human-wildlife conflict with gulls, chip stealing, something that would create a lot of animosity towards these animals. And so they're looking for a solution that isn't invasive, that helps us coexist with these animals without sort of having to change too much about either of our ways of life.
That's a great point, yeah.
Now I feel bad for taking the piss out of it, because that's, like, really, like, a valid piece of research.
No, I just, it makes complete sense, but in my head it's like, so we'll, in the UK we're going to start getting adverts on the TV like, don't run from seagulls, stare at them.
Yes, save a gull today, just stare it down.
Like, these are going to be, it's going to be, like, taught in schools, like a PSA, you know, just like...
Yeah.
Other countries are like, don't start forest fires. We're like, stare at seagulls.
Only you can stare at seagulls.
We need you to stare at seagulls.
That's what a delightful... That was such an interesting, like, so many different bits of research and stuff like that, and so many different examples were so fantastic. And then that's the answer, and I just love it so much.
I love it. I love taking people on a journey to just nowhere. It's amazing.
I learned a lot during it. So
yeah.
I also love being able to kind of like with the thermal biology, being able to take just like the strangest perspective at looking at the animal kingdom, right? Through this like almost like pseudo legal perspective with like theft. As a way of like, because you kept listing animals across the animal kingdom, and it's just a very interesting way of looking at things, at animals from a perspective that we don't usually, which I think is really cool.
I'm Lisa Hannawalt.
And I'm Emily Heller.
Wow, Emily, we've been doing this podcast for 10 years.
I know, but hey, don't worry. You can jump in at literally any episode and hear us talk about some of our favorite stuff. Caterpillars becoming butterflies.
Martha Stewart flying around in a private jet full of trees. Yes, you heard me right. Trees.
Neighbors becoming enemies. Just kidding.
Whatever messed up stuff we can find on Wikipedia.
Our impeccable taste in everything from dogs to TV shows to bodily functions.
And horses. Lots and lots of horses. Come for our horned up rants about the world. Stay for the catchy theme songs.
You might not learn anything, but we're a good hang.
Baby geniuses. Every other week on MaximumFun.org.
My question is, and I am very interested to hear your answer, what is Australia's best animal in your opinion?
So the best animal in Australia is Antechinus.
Wait, what?
Well, if you don't know what it is, you can guess what it is. So it's any member of the genus Antechinus. So I will just give you the word and you can guess what it maybe looks like.
Caroline, you have to guess last because I feel like you might have an upper
I can give you this. A hint. I can give you like what kind of class it's in or something.
Antechinus.
Yeah, go to class.
Okay.
I have an opinion.
An opinion?
Oh, not a guess. An opinion.
Like, just like something about it gives me insecty vibes. Am I anywhere
I was
close?
Also getting insecty vibes, but yeah. Only because it starts
not at
with
all?
Ants.
No. Oh, really?
It's a mammal.
I was going to think in somewhere in the like rodent. I feel like there's a lot of great rodents in Australia. I could be wrong about that though.
It's closer.
What's the class?
Ooh. So it's closer in the sense that it gets mistaken for a rodent a lot.
What gets mistaken for a rodent a lot?
Wallaby.
Closer.
Man.
It is man. Would you like me to tell you what it is? Or you can actually Google
yes,
it.
Please.
Do you want to Google it, actually? Because I think it
would be
better. Okay, so it's A.
Yeah, live react.
It's Antechinus. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, it's so cute.
What? I've never heard of this thing.
Yeah, absolutely not.
A lot of Australians haven't either.
I see why it's mistaken for a rodent.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
To describe it for the It's not a rodent.
It's not a rodent. It's a marsupial.
How? Okay, it has a pouch. Okay, so describe it for the listeners. It is basically looks like a mouse with a long little snout. It's very cute.
It's very, very cute. So they're in sort of, they're a dasyurid, which is the same group as like Tasmanian devils and quolls and stuff. So they're these little carnivorous animals. Usually they eat insects, but they will eat like, you know, like a lizard or something from time to time. And I love them because the females live for about 2 to 3 years. The males live for 11 months.
What? No.
So this is great. When they get to their first breeding season, the males go into such a horny frenzy that they don't eat or sleep. Their body is flooded with corticosteroids to give them more energy, which also suppresses their immune system and causes stomach ulcers. So they basically just mate because they've just been flooded with all this energy, no eating, no sleeping, and then they die at the end of their first mating season. Live fast, die young. Antikinus, do it well.
Jesus Christ.
Okay, yeah, that is a pretty good animal. It's pretty good.
Also, did not expect it from this little guy.
No, 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 that's like, it's such a cute looking animal, and it just, what?
They're just the randomest little dudes that is like... absolute icons.
They could live for another year. They could. And they were just like, nah.
So they have occasionally been known to survive their first breeding season, but very, very rarely. And females will have about 12 offspring. They're like on Google, there's some really freaky pictures of like looking into a female Antikinus pouch. And it's basically just a circle on their tummy where it's like a bunch of little jelly bean babies.
Oh, I think they're really cute.
Yeah, they're very, very cool.
Marsupials are weird.
Oh, it really does look like little jelly beans, doesn't it?
Yeah, they're like little tiny. So like a lot of the time, like on naturalist groups on Facebook and stuff, you'll get people posting like, what's this? Like, I think it's a dead rat in my yard. I think someone's like been baiting it or something, and it's an Antikinus. Because it's like a lot of Aussies as well just don't know about them, so don't even know like how to recognize them. They just see something like that. And like, oh, it's a rat.
To be fair, there are so many weird animals in Australia. I was just going to say.
Why did I think that when I saw this cute little guy that it wouldn't have some fucked up story to it? Of course, why would I think that you would just pick one that was just...
Nothing here is okay.
Is Australia okay?
Animals really do it differently in Australia. They go hard. Any kind of animal elsewhere, like a European version of it, it's way harder. It's tougher, it's meaner, it's more poisonous in Australia.
Absolutely.
We were worried about gulls, and you guys have Antikinus. Like,
also, your gulls are venomous, right? In Australia?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. No, I think actually what they do is they unhinge their jaws and eat people in Australia, as we've discussed.
So they paralyze you, and then they swallow you whole.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
Great, okay, that's amazing. What was your question, Caroline?
Mine was, what's up with your beef with blathers? Do you want to, for anybody who's not an Animal Crossings fan, do you want to first describe who Blathers is and then what's up with that?
so Blathers in Animal Crossing is this little owl character, and when you collect bugs or fossils or fish, you take them to the museum and Blathers will explain what they are to you and he'll give you some facts about them. And so I have a series on TikTok where I just nitpick his explanations and just kind of rip them apart. And so it's actually all a bit of a lie. I'm a fraud. He's my favourite character. I love him.
It's He's jealousy. The best. It's pure jealousy. It's wish you were Blathers.
Yes, exactly.
I think it's like a fake reality show beef. You're just like playing it up for the cameras.
Exactly. It's like it's our beef, it's our character, it's like it's my character arc that just like I have. but it's also because like I just think that being hyperbolic and pedantic is really funny. Like I just love nitpicking stuff. Like, like my favorite movie is Jurassic Park, and half of that is because I get to like anytime I watch it, I just like info dump to the people around me about dinosaurs, and I use the nitpicking as like an excuse to do that.
I mean, to be fair, one of my favorite things is to get really, really mad about them getting DNA from mosquitoes in amber. I'm like, that DNA would not be preserved well enough to a whole dinosaur genome. that dinosaur exactly. would be fucked up.
And it's so fun. It's so cathartic. It's like, it just, you know, it feels good. It's like, yeah, I'm smarter than the movie producers from 20 years ago.
I feel like the info dumping perspective of it is very nice, where it's a springboard to talk about some of the stuff that you're interested in with this blather stuff also.
Yeah, for sure. And there's also a slight mistrust of owls, which stems from playing Ocarina of Time as a child and being really frustrated by the owl in that, Kaipora Gaibora, who, like, when, like, he would talk to you with this really long...
skipping the tutorial.
Yeah.
Yep.
He would have this, like, really long dialogue that you just skip through, and then right at the end where it's like, do you want me to continue? Yes, no. The developers switched those around so that you hit no and he repeats again, and it's just the worst thing in the world. So there's always been, like, truly a little part cruel. Of me that's like, ooh, any owl characters I'm just a little bit mad at.
And Blathers also famously talks a lot.
Yeah,
so
exactly. They all talk a lot. What's up with that? Nintendo.
Do you have a favorite fact of his that you've corrected? And also, do you have a favorite specimen in Animal Crossing, like a fossil or an auric or a,
oh,
I'm a big
question.
Fan of the what's the really long, the oar fish in Animal Crossing?
Yes!
Is my favorite when you catch, it's just super long,
so good.
I just think the new Animal Crossing, the museum is really beautiful.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. So I'm also a bit of a poser because New Horizons is the only Animal Crossing I've ever played. I didn't, like, have a DS or anything, so this was, like, the one that, like, I got into it with. But no, yeah, the museum is, like, I want to live there. It's so nice.
The jealousy of Blathers continues.
Yeah.
we're really breaking this down.
I'm just seething. God. My favorite, like, Blathers video that I've done, I had fun making the shark one, even though, there was a bit in that when I was editing it where I realized I'd completely, like, misrepresented some data and I had to, like, put this wall of text over what I was saying to, like, correct myself.
It's good of you to do, though, you know.
I was gonna say... I wish every single TikToker had that thought where they're like, oh man, am I misrepresenting data? I truly wish more people had that thought.
Oh yeah, no, it was my compromise because when I realized, I was like, I could just leave it, but no, I could never. And so then I was like, I could delete it, but then I was like, no, I'm so attached and it doesn't make anything make sense. But I had a lot of fun making that one because I was, like, researching, like, great white sharks and how long they could survive in captivity and why they weren't surviving in captivity and all of that stuff. And yeah, I found that one really enjoyable. And I'd say my favorite specimen is probably, it's got to be the rainbow fish just because it looks exactly like a Murray rainbow fish. And I still have that attachment from my cancelled experiment.
Oh, yeah.
So I have in my house, I have one of those in a tank.
Oh, yeah. And that was right around the pandemic.
Yeah. It was literally salting
like,
the wound.
I could do this study here. This
I first
fine.
Caught it literally, I think like 2 weeks after my experiment had been cancelled. I first caught the rainbow fish and I was like, this is just crushing
That's
me.
Devastating.
Cruel.
That's so harsh. Yeah.
Ash, since we have you on and we revel in any chance to talk trash and talk deep about TikTok, can we ask how you got started on there? Because that's where I first ran into you.
Yeah. So I started, I'd sort of had it before the pandemic, but didn't really post much.
Before it was cool.
Yeah, before it was cool. Before it was cool, you know. And then, like, after the pandemic, so, like, the first lockdown in Melbourne ended right as I finished my honours. So I had basically just spent that whole time inside just working on a spreadsheet and I was going insane. And so when I finished it, I was like, I have to do something creative or I'm going to die. So I was just like making TikToks just to get that, like, out of me because I had literally just been working with data for months and months and months and I just needed something, like, you know, just that was, like, talking and writing and stuff like that. And I was also interested in, like, a career in science communication. So I was like, I'll use this to build my resume. And so I did that. And it actually did end up helping me get a couple of jobs, which was, like, really, really neat.
Nice.
They're like, we also hate Blathers. That motherfucker.
Yeah, they're like, fuck that guy. You're hired.
That, like, anxiety about being... especially with science stuff, being correct on TikTok is so real, though. And I know I definitely, like, take it way, way too extreme, which is partly why I don't post as much.
I do get that, like, paranoia, though. Like, I feel, because it's, like, on the internet, like, there's always just, like, I was actually reading, like, this Twitter thread about it today, which was just, like, so true. It's, like, you're making this content for, like, thousands of people, but you're also making it for the 12 people that are going to just take it in bad faith. And so you're kind of, like, anticipating that.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But no, I've done the thing where, like, I mispronounced a word. I actually once filmed a whole video mispronouncing a word, and I, like, fully just deleted it because I was like, there's no, like, it wasn't a well-known word, but I was just, like, so scared that someone was going to be like, oh, you've mispronounced this, and then the whole thing would be ruined. So I, like, fully refilmed it.
And if we do keep this in listeners, this anxiety is not correct. It is more often than not you should
leave. It's just paranoia.
Yeah, I did a video on buoyancy, and like 10 minutes after I put it up, I realized I had spelled it wrong every single time. I had, like, switched up the O-U-Y or something like that.
Oh, no.
And I literally, this was a good thing, because I think so what I did was then I just posted a friends only video where I was like, I fucked up. I really hope no one notices. I'm going to go roller skate and not think about it.
Yeah.
And then I broke my hand, which was unrelated. Well, and so then I learned, that I should have deleted it. Then I wouldn't have broken my hand. No, but literally not. There was not one single comment that mentioned the typo.
You know what I do? When I post something and I realize I've got something wrong, like I often mispronounce words. But even if I know how to pronounce them, I do it in videos. And then I just put in a comment saying, I did this. I just straight up say if you go into most of my videos, I'm like, I did this wrong, and no one talks about it. Then they're like, ha, maybe underneath.
Yeah, I feel like that's a good way of doing it.
I was doing a video about the nudibranchs that take in the chloroplasts and like photosynthesize and stuff like that, and I'd said the word algae, which obviously is pronounced differently in different places.
I remember this.
Yeah. And just like the number of comments being like, algae, you're pronouncing it algae, it's algae, come on, like it's algae. I'm just being like, nothing that I could do could make the algae comments stop. And it wasn't even like they weren't overly negative or anything, they were just like surprised at hearing this word this way for the first time. But that was like, I'm gonna have to like turn the comments off on this. I just can't
again, this shows that we are the anxious about misrepresenting data kinds of people, because what we should be thinking is like, oh, that's engagement, baby. Comments away
for sure.
That's why I always like acknowledge my mistakes. I'm like, I don't want people to correct me. I don't want that kind of engagement. I'm like, there you go, I know what I did is wrong. I just found on one of my videos from a couple of weeks ago. I don't even know what this video is about, but I say erudite, but I said erudite by accident, and I just thought I said
love
erudite.
That. I love
that's
that.
The comment. That's the top comment on that video.
That's such a freeing way to say it, just to literally say, just to be like, I said that, and not even be like sorry, just be like, that's what I said.
Yeah, no one can even get at you for that. Speaking of preempting. I just, Caroline, for what you were saying, I realized when I was talking, I think I mispronounced nudibranch. I think I said nudibranch, and I don't, I've only ever read it.
Literally, who's
valid.
Gonna?
Are both valid?
You can say both.
Okay,
like, that's how it's spelled. But it's, I think it's just you a also, difference
I,
in places.
I didn't want to, I can probably edit it in post. I didn't want to correct you because you seemed like you were on a roll, but you did keep saying chip instead of fry.
Sorry, what's that word? I don't know that word.
Yeah, you might not be erudite enough to know the phrase.
Hi, I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart.
And I'm Jordan Morris, boy detective.
Our comedy podcast, Jordan Jesse Go, just celebrated its 15th anniversary.
It was a couple months ago, but we forgot.
Yeah, completely. Our silly show is 15 years old. That makes it old enough to get its learner's permit.
And almost old enough to get the talk.
Wow, I hope you got the talk before then. A lot of things have changed in 15 years. Our show's not one of them.
We're never changing, and you can't make us.
Jordan, Jesse, Go, the same forever at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, do y'all have any plugs or shoutouts? Ash, we're going to go to you first as our esteemed guest.
Thank you. So I am Trash Bandicoot on TikTok. Bandicoot is spelled like with a K instead of a C in there because I couldn't get that handle.
No.
I'm Ashlyn underscore Campbell on Twitter.
And all those links will be in our bio. We'll be in the info. We'll be in the description. What the fuck is it called? Sorry.
Like,
sorry. Oh, thank you. That's the word.
Jesus.
And was it shout outs as well?
Yeah, if you have any.
Yeah.
I want to shout out Luca's Biohub because they also dress up as like Blathers sometimes and like talk about bugs and stuff in character. And also some other TikTokers that I really look up to. Dr. Kylie Soans, who talks about urban biodiversity. And sort of wildlife conservation in urban areas. Sarah Webb Science, who's an astrophysicist and talks about really cool space stuff. And Astro Kirsten is also a really cool astrophysicist who talks about space stuff.
Yeah.
And also Zoe Keen-Sai, who's a really cool science journalist who also talks about, you know, the native flora and fauna of Australia and just really cool, like, facts and all that.
Amazing.
Thank you so much. Those are some great shout-outs. Some fantastic people to go and follow there. Yes. Definitely.
Check them out. They're very good. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been so much fun.
Of course. Truly really such a joy.
Thank you so much for joining. And doing so much research as well.
Like, yeah, that was great. We really appreciate it.
Did a deep dive there, which I really appreciate.
I was just frothing at the mouth with that stuff. I was enjoying it so much.
All right. I'm just going to quickly plug the three of us. I'm Tom Lumpers in all places. Ella is Dr. Big Science Energy on TikTok and at Ella Hubber on Twitter. And Caroline is Caroline the Bug on all places. You can find all of our links at letslearneverythingpod.com. Join the Discord, get a t-shirt, get a mug, all that good stuff. So today we learned about kleptoparasitism and all the absolutely wild ways that animals steal things. But most importantly, we learned that the strategy is to stare gulls directly into their souls to keep your chips safe. We learned about Australia's best animal, according to Ash. And of course, we learned a lot about our wonderful guest. And you can all join us next time, where we will learn about
everything.
Let's Learn Everything is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted and produced by Ella Hubber, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper, with editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum.
Also, before we start recording, if you ever say anything that later you want us to edit out, just let us know and we can totally do that.
Yeah, so if I, like, say I murdered someone in, like, my Ford Fiesta, like, you'll cut that out. That's all good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. That's good content.
Awesome. This becomes a true crime podcast.
That's your question.
It's like, how do you get away with murder? Like,
what's the statute of limitations for Ford Fiesta murders? Oh, God, the specificity was what scared me. All right, let's rock and roll.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.